Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns. Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/acast. That's burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
So, hey, everybody, welcome to episode 217 of the Morden Just Code podcast. My name is Tim Mitra, and I am in Toronto, Ontario, and I'm joined once again by Jaime Lippis Jr. in Seattle, Washington.
How's it going?
And we have Mark Rubin on the line down in San Jose, California.
Hello.
I don't know why I was going to say San Francisco. I'm not sure. Pretty it's all by. The same, huh?
Not the same, but it's close enough.
Yeah, I know. Well, so I think the Bay Area is very similar to the GTA. It's all like connected cities from one end to the other, right?
It is. Yeah. And all the cities put together, it's pretty large.
Yeah.
It's probably the third largest metropolitan area in the U.S. after the New York area and the L.A. area.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And Toronto's the same thing. Like the GTA goes from Whitby all the way through Toronto and then almost around the nose of the lake, right? So the St. Catharines and Stony Creek and Hamilton. Stop screaming at your screen. All right. So, Jaime, I have a little bit of fact check from last week. Last week, I mentioned Rob Napier's talk, and I think I said server and lies, or maybe security and lies, but it's actually secrets and lies, and that's from 360 iDev. And I was stumbling with the Astropad guy who was on Roundabout Creative Chaos with Tammy and myself. His name is Matt Rouge. Rogue, I think he's pronounced it, but it's actually it's spelled Rouge, like the French word for red, but he said that I think his family's lost that pronunciation years ago. Just as a side note, my Luna display arrived today, so I got to take it out for a quick spin on around the block there. So Matt Rouge and his company Astropad brought out Astropad, and they're the ones that just made the Luna display. So we'll talk about that in a bit. Anyway, Jaime, I put an AskMTJC here. It's not really an AskMTJC.
It's spiritually in line with that, right? It's from friend of the show, Sean Marston, says, a beautiful day in CDG. I think that's Charles de Gaulle. Listening right. Tim Mitra double bill, the MTJC podcast and Roundabout FM. And it looks like that's an Air France Concorde jet behind him.
Boarding a WWDC MTJC t-shirt from this year. Yeah. And I followed up with saying, hey, have you heard of Spotcast? And interesting to see that he said he tried to listen to it, but it talks about Star Trek Discovery, which he can't watch in the UK, so he gave up. I wonder if that's because he did not show Discovery on Netflix in the UK?
I have no idea. I assumed it was Netflix everywhere except the United States.
Yeah. Well, in Canada, we have it on Space, right? But and as we mentioned on Spotcast last week that the shorts, the little 20-minute ones that are doing as teasers, they're not available. So and I tried to lure him back by telling him we talked about your exploits with Doctor Who last week. So
that's right. I have to watch the next episode of Doctor Who. And
you haven't watched the second one yet?
I haven't watched the second one yet. And the season premiere of Supergirl, I'll probably have to watch that too. Season 4.
Right, yeah, watch that one. So how are you acquiring, am I allowed to ask how you're acquiring Doctor Who?
I'm doing it on the up and up. It's not, I'm not doing it illegally. It was
just checking.
It was like $2 on Amazon for the BBC America. Just buy the episode or buy access to the episode. I think it was
like
normally
$2
an episode. I think it was like $3 to $4 if you wanted it in. I don't know if it was in 4K or maybe it was just HD. But I got the SD version, which if you ask me, it looked like a DVD, so it didn't look too bad to me.
Yeah,
for $2, and then I think if I go back now, the season pass would be $18. I think it was $19 for a season pass.
So can you load up Space TV or on your browser?
Space TV, like spacetv.com or spacetv.ca or something?
I think so. In the show notes, it's been there several times. Let me look.
Space.ca, is that what it is? Watch free episodes of Doctor Who. Free preview on now. What? All right, let's see. Let's see if it'll show. Oh, no, look at that. It's got a big old lock symbol on it. So what I see is The Woman Who Fell to Earth, which is episode one, is available, I think, but I have a lock on The Ghost Monument.
Oh, so you can watch. You can watch the first episode.
It says I can watch the season premiere for. I might have to turn off Ghostery or something because it's complaining that content is not available for viewing in your browser. Which I'd be shocked if Chrome wasn't supported.
Well, it could be reverse CRTC or something.
Yeah, that's probably just like the default error message they put up.
Yeah,
here it is. 2018. We can't watch we can't watch material seamlessly from other countries.
I know. It's like what is this? You know, we can chat. We can do podcasts. We can't. Like, you know,
I mean, this is ultimate proof, right, of like the meta thing about this podcast, and that it's never a technology problem, it's always a people problem.
Yeah, a policy problem.
People involved with laws problem and distribution rights.
Well, yeah, it's the ownership of the show. I mean, Jonathan was complaining about the fact that last week that he couldn't watch something, but it wasn't it's a Flash, right? And it's because no Canadian broadcaster bought the rights to the show. That's why you can't watch it. I can't remember who had it on last year. I think it was it was Space, I can't remember, or CTV or something. Anyway, that's too bad. We'll move on. So thanks, Sean, for the shout out on the Twitter machine there. Always welcome. And you're missing some great banter on Spotcast, that's all I gotta say, right? Especially with Jonathan on the show.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so we have some follow-up, and you've got the first item here, right, Jaime?
Yeah, an episode or two ago, we were talking about iOS 12 adoption being somewhat slow, and I guess it picked up a bit in the past week or two, because according to this article, iOS adoption is progressing faster on 12 than it was on 11. Now it's installed at 50% of iOS devices.
This is based on the chart on Apple's own site. So I think Mark mentioned a lot two weeks ago, and it was from, I forget which site it was, but...
So I posted the Mixpanel chart, which showed what pretty much everyone has been saying is that initially, the first few weeks, it was a little slow, but then it picked up and it surpassed the rate at which iOS 11 was adopted. So it's far ahead now.
It's a pretty stable OS, I mean, comparatively speaking, right? So I haven't found anything weird about it.
I wonder if it started out a little slow, if people are like, I don't know if there's anything exciting, and other folks, you know, word of mouth as we speculated, like, oh, it's actually pretty good on my old phone, and then it didn't make it terrible. So, oh, okay, I guess I'll update then. Get me some new, you know, emoji.
Now, I have found a couple of things where an app built against the iOS 11 libraries running on iOS 12 have some bugs, some issues.
Really? Like what?
I found a couple of them. One of them was something to do with decoding video and showing video and you know, the AV Foundation classes.
Yeah, I getcha.
What was the other one? I can't remember the other one, but that was the big one. But there was at least one more. Oh yeah. There was one place where the constraint system it appears to change the order that they do things. So I had one case where initially it was setting up the constraints and there was just something hadn't been set up yet. So a variable was essentially not a number because it just hadn't been defined yet. And I was using it in a calculation for a constraint. So in iOS 11, it wasn't worried about that because it was setting up the constraints first before it defined the number and then you tried to do the calculation. But in iOS 12, again, building into iOS 11 libraries and running on iOS 12, there was a case where it was trying to use the results of the calculation in the constraint before the value had been set up, which was a little strange. And of course, that would crash the app. So easily fixed, but you just, you know, you don't know it until you try it. And the good old days where you could just take an app and use it in all future versions of iOS seem to be gone. And it used to be that way, right? It used to be back in the old days, you could, you know, you'd compile something against iOS 3 and it would be still working great in iOS 6.
Yeah, I wonder about that sometimes because, you know, we get the weirdest, like we support a lot of OSs and versions like we're, you know, two, three, 3 versions back, as well as multiple devices. And it's the strangest bugs come back to us from QA with, a Mac Mini or an iPad Mini and this OS has this particular bug, and, you know, whether it's an animation or something doesn't quite fit right, or some constraints not being honored or what have you, right? So, And it's just these weird little edge cases that can't come back to us all the time, right?
Mm-hmm.
Very strange.
Yep.
Very strange.
But other than that, it's been pretty good, I have to say.
Cool. Yep. All right. Well, the next one here is from me, and I titled it Surprise. It turns out that Facebook, in fact, can use the data that they collect from portal devices in the in-home devices that they have there to target you. So they're initially, and if you read the story here from Recode, initially they had said that they were told that they wouldn't be using the data, and, you know, that they collect through the home device. Portal in-home. Now they've come back on, they've retracted that, and they're saying that, in fact, they can. So
what a shocker.
I know, eh?
I'm giving them the benefit of the doubt, of just given the way that it happened, that Facebook itself reached out to correct things rather than
maybe
like an investigative report discovered, or some rogue engineer decided to tell the press. What I'm thinking happened here is the exec in charge of Portal probably stated what they believed to be true, not realizing until somebody in the engineering team's like, hey, bro, you know we're using Messenger infrastructure, right? Yeah. You realize that infrastructure tracks the heck out of everything for various metric reasons, and we can do ad correlation, right? Okay, we better reach out and correct this thing so it doesn't look like we're hiding something.
Right, yeah.
It's still bad. Like, they really should be really careful about that sort of thing, sort of in general, but more specifically given all of the attention given to privacy, not only in general, but specifically related to them.
Yeah. Actually, it's interesting. I saw an article today. I didn't grab it, though. I thought we had enough to talk about today, but I saw an article earlier today from Amber Mack saying that, the byline was, you shouldn't be using Facebook to log into all these from other apps, probably for similar reasons that, Facebook is basically collecting data through that, right? They have the potential to collect data through your activity and other apps as well.
Oh, interesting. I hadn't heard of it from that angle. I heard of it from now you've given the keys to one party, which I think I used to look at Facebook and Google, and to a lesser extent, Twitter login as being, more secure and definitely more convenient than trying to manage, a whole slew of passwords and everything. But in an era of, one password and LastPass existing, and how tightly it's been integrated into the iOS and Mac ecosystem, it just seems like a risk you wouldn't want to take anymore. It seems like, you should just use 1Password or another password manager, like iCloud Keychain or something, instead, because it's not any more difficult to just use those to generate. Like, it will even suggest stuff for you now, right? Like, here, press this button here, stop being lazy, and we'll generate one for you, we'll store it for you, rather than having to defer to parties like, big attractive parties like Google and Facebook and Twitter.
Right. And I can't find the link for it. I'll put it in the show notes and we can talk about it next week. But this is apparently there's some big story in Canada today with some sort of introduction of some law that they changed. So it seems to be dominating the Canadian news landscape today. So
yeah, I imagine it wasn't a very productive day in Canada.
I don't know. Apparently they ran out of supply halfway through the day, which is no surprise to me at all.
No Cheetos available at any convenience store anywhere. No.
They ran out of Max milk, Max chocolate milk. Exactly. Yeah. It's funny. One of the credits on the Rush's album 20 or all the world's a stage is a live recording. And if you look at the liner notes, they think, this particular, we have a chain of stores, or we had a chain of stores named Becker's, and they thanked Becker's chocolate milk on the liner notes. I'll let you figure that one out. Mark probably gets it. All right.
No, I have no idea.
You have no idea? Oh.
Okay, good.
So it soothes your throat. You know what I'm saying?
Uh-huh.
Anyway, very important product here in Canada. This was a quick one. I just read that Apple is... we've been talking about this as a follow-up again on Apple and their forays into competing with Netflix and Amazon Prime. An article here about the fact that they're going to be providing content to the Apple devices, Apple TV, Watch, and phone, I suppose, for free, apparently, according to this article from LA Biz. You guys seen this or heard about this?
Yeah, I heard about this and it didn't make 100% sense to me. I feel like they're missing something here because I thought Apple would end up using this sort of content to drive, you know, of course, more devices. Mm-hmm. And that makes sense. Cool. But they're increasingly trying to bring in that subscription revenue. And I was a little unclear how giving away content would work towards that, unless it was a, okay, you get this one series for free, but if you want to see all these other good series, maybe you can watch it live, but if you didn't see it, you know, that day, then, well, pony up your $9.99 a month for Apple Music, and not only do you get the music, but you also get to watch our original content.
Oh, that may be how, yeah, for sure.
Yeah,
If you click on one of the links or read more links in the article, it takes you back to Mark's favorite news website, CNBC. Is that correct, Mark?
My favorite news site? Why do you say that?
aren't you suspicious of CNBC?
A little bit. They're not as bad as some others, though. I actually can't read this article because it's behind a paywall. Could you guys read it where you are?
Which, the CNBC one or?
No, the Biz Journal one.
Oh really? No. It didn't hit me with a paywall.
Huh.
Did you reach your monthly maximum or something? Like happens to me with the New York Times occasionally.
Well, here, let me grab this other link here. Copy this link. This is the link to the other site. So they put a paywall in front of a link to another website, which they don't control. Beautiful. Wonderful. Wonderful idea.
They do mention that maybe this content would be free through the TV app or drive you to use the app. And then content through other partners like HBO and Stars would be available through a channels subscription, which sort of makes sense to me because I'm sure there's others that do this, but the one that comes to mind is Amazon, where hypothetically, if I wanted to, I could, you know, pay through Amazon for CBS All Access and HBO and Showtime and probably a whole bunch of others that are not coming to mind. I think to make the billing and everything else a little bit more seamless is probably the play there. And I assume that Amazon, or in this case, Apple, if they were fulfilling that role, would get a cut of that revenue or get it's probably like a recurring cut rather than like a finder's fee, like a one-time, you know, oh, great, we got a subscription signed up and here's $100 sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
We'll see. They said it was going to be released in early 2019, so that's not too far away, and I'm sure more things will leak out about this in the future.
Yeah, I mean, like you said, it could be part of your Apple Music subscription. That could be part of where it's coming from. All right. So this is last week I mentioned at the end of the show that I just found out about the CBC investigative report thing about Apple overcharging for repairs. And I had a chance to go back and watch the video. It's actually a special news report that was on our national broadcast here. And it covers a bunch of different things. One in particular is, you know, they take a hidden camera thing with a MacBook Pro with a display issue into the Apple store, and the genius says he takes it in the back and comes back, and you know the little indicators that indicate whether the devices had water damage or water exposure had changed colors. And so he comes back and he says, you know, you need to change all these parts for us to you know, give it a blessing and say it's repaired. And then they take the same computer to some repair place in I want to say Brooklyn, to a gentleman named put the note here, yeah, Lewis Rossman, who does repairs for we have a couple of small repair shops like this in Toronto too, but they took this one to the US, and he found a bent pin and he just bent it back and you know, put the computer back together, and it was the display problem went away, right? I guess it was like an intermittent backlit problem, but you know, and Apple wanted like $1,000 or $1,200 Canadian to repair it, and he said it was a free repair for him to do it for these guys. And so the question that, you know, comes back to, I don't know, you guys are familiar with the website iFixit, which takes apart phones and stuff like that. They have this, you know, $28 million business, you know, repairing phones and selling parts to people. So they're on there, and their chief guy is a spokesman for the Right to Repair group in the United States. And there's a link here I've got in the show their statement on the Right to Repair stuff. And they're claiming that, you know, Apple's kind of locking us in and, you know, making us pay a lot of money to repair things. And which could be true. I've always been a proponent of AppleCare as a cheap solution to that. But and you know, and we know that Apple parts are not cheap, right? So they're, you know, things break down, you're going to get them fixed, right? And I will be honest that I've noticed in some of these CBC reports that, at least this is my opinion, that they tend to not tell the story straight up. I find that sometimes they'll be critical and they're trying to raise these, you know, consumer alerts about things, and they're not always, you know, they'll say, we tried to contact Apple, but they, you know, declined to comment. Well, maybe they didn't answer the phone is the actual truth or whatever, which, I mean, I'm not saying that's the case here, but I find that sometimes to sensationalize the story, they kind of like, they skip over some of the details, you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Anyway, but because they do make it look like, you know, they make it look like, well, it could have been fixed for free, but the guy at Apple, the genius at the Apple store is basically reading from a chart that says, you try this, you try that, and you tell the customer this is what it costs to fix. I mean, they probably get a ton.
They don't know. People. They're like high school kids half the time, right?
Exactly. They don't know how to fix the thing. No offense to any geniuses out there, but
well, high school kids,
or Apple geniuses, or anybody who resembles an Apple genius.
So I agree with, in general, with the right to repair thing. I mean, I think you should have the right to. I mean, you bought it, you know, you should be able to fix it. But I kind of do see where Apple's coming from at the same time. You know, you could kind of look at it in two ways. You could look at it as Apple as the evil, you know, empire just trying to get every last dollar out of us by making us buy new things instead of being able to fix them. But I kind of think it's not. I mean, maybe there's a little bit of that, but it's not really that. I think the real reason,
that's not the intention. They are concerned about everybody having a great experience, right?
Yeah. And it's a lot of it is cost, right? If you made these super small, you know, thin devices in such a way that they were easily repairable, it would have cost a lot more to design them and manufacture them. And so the initial cost would be way, way higher than it is. So by trading off some of that flexibility, we get a lower cost product that we can buy. So yeah, I mean, I can see both sides.
I mean, if you want a wafer thin Microsoft Surface, they've got to apply some engineering tricks, you know, like they have to use glues and things like that to get these small pieces together, right? Because the same with an iPad. I mean, an iPad is like pretty much glued together, or the battery in your phone. I mean, it is a shame that, you know, you used to be able to change the battery on a Nokia or a BlackBerry, but then again, the battery was like half the size of an Altoids tin, you know, which meant that the phone could only be so thin. But anyway, the story goes on to tell about Geekbench, which is an app developed by a Canadian, developer right here in Toronto, who discovered the discrepancy about the phone thing that we talked about 6 months ago, I guess, when the big conspiracy about Apple throttling the performance of your phone if the battery didn't hold in as much charge. And Apple claimed at the time that they were doing it to prevent, you know, your phone from shutting down unusually or whatever. And so what they did was they threw their big Geekbench software. They found that as the phone aged, it actually was running slower. And the solution was, according to a Reddit article, which I've got a link in here, is just replace the battery, and then all of a sudden your performance, you know, shot back up again. And we talked about this at the time I think Apple had a system update in, I think, was it in 11 or 10, where they were tuning the performance of the phone, is how they put it, I believe. Remember that?
Yeah, it's an option now. You could say, I want full power, you know, on the engine, but if it randomly stops at 45%, okay, I explicitly opted into this experience.
Yeah. And I mean, I've noticed that ever since I've had a watch too. There's a lot of communication going back and forth that you know, like my phones don't last the entire day because I'm, you know, I'm using my watch all the time, and it's using the phone as it's piggybacking on the phone, and the two of them are communicating all day long, right? They talk about this Shanna Scarlett, who's, you know, has a class action lawsuit against Apple for, you know, reaching into people's phones and, you know, without their permission and throttling the device, right? So it's you can buy into the argument that Apple is doing this, but I think it's just a bit of, you know, conspiracy theory sauce on there, right?
Yep.
But it's an interesting read. I think people should watch the video and follow the links I've got here in the show notes. It's an interesting perspective on, you know, the man and what he does to us, right? Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think it's kind of tricky. I do definitely think people have the right to repair. I don't think that's necessarily the same, or should not be conflated at the very least with ease of repair. It might take specialized tools to do it for some of the reasons that Mark talked about, right? That, you know, if you're going to manufacture it at scale at a certain cost and have it be, you know, so performant or so thin, like you can't just use a random, like, you know, normal Phillips screwdriver to put the thing together, right? It's not like that anymore. I do think that things should generally be repairable by the user or, you know, by third parties, with maybe the one carve out being that there should be special consideration given for security related related things. Remember when people got really grumpy that they replaced the Touch ID sensor and they would get the mysterious error 53 thing?
Right. Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I think that was a legitimate security thing. So they, you know, people can't surreptitiously change the Touch ID sensor and confuse you, trick you into thinking that you've got, you know, a normal sensor in there and everything related to the secure enclave. But I also don't think that Apple should just have like, error 53 sucks to be you. Like, it really should have been a more helpful, like, please take this to an Apple center and have and triage that. Like, I feel like that's one of those areas that would be rather difficult for you to repair yourself without it compromising security in some way. And so I think it'd be incumbent on Apple to make sure that that particular repair is, you know, fair and reasonable for folks if they become the true single source for that.
Well, that's true. But I mean, like, the whole thing, I believe that part of the Touch ID sensor is involved in well, there's hardware encryption on the device that encrypts. It's part of the encryption process, right? And just like we were talking last week, well, if I want to get around it, I just change the key, right? And then I can get in, right? So yeah, you're right. I think there has to be, it's a certain amount of control that has to be, you know, put in place to protect us from ourselves, to be honest with you, right? You know, you don't want strange people getting, I don't want people getting at my data. Like, you know, like I have contacts in my address book that would just be frankly embarrassing for other people to get a hold of, right? You know, because they're
like,
they're,
what?
Well, the people who trust me, like, you know.
I'm kidding.
No, it's like I have customers that trust that I'll keep their privacy, right? Or their information private. That's why they come to me. There's, you know, what do you call it? It's the talk about with Apple all the time. It's basically a trust relationship, right? I forgot the terminology for it, but you want to protect that, and that's one of the reasons why I don't. I mean, I'm always, you know, shaking my head at people who don't put passcodes on their phones, and, you know, or don't use Face ID or Touch ID, and wonder why, you know, we put these, why these blocks are put in their place. I mean, we're digressing from the whole story about this repair stuff, but you know, I think I agree with the idea that, you know, you can't just change a Touch ID sensor or a home button, right? So, and there's lots of third party batteries out there and stuff like that too, and they may or may not be just the same spec or standard that Apple expects them to be at, right? And that could affect the performance of your device or longevity of it as well, right? Yep. Mm-hmm. All right. So what do you want to do? Talk about next, Jaime, the user downloads or Photoshop?
Let's talk about the Photoshop thing. Let's just go straight down the list.
All right. So, yeah. So we've been talking for a long time about the fact that, you know, we want pro apps on the iPad. One of the products that, you know, a lot of people use, I use it all the time, is, I mean, you know, several times a week, is Photoshop, right? And Apple has announced that they're going to provide a version of Photoshop CC or Creative Cloud for the iPad coming up in the future. So, and I posted an article in here, and so did Jaime. So we have two different sources here. So what have you got in your source there, Jaime?
It's an announcement from Adobe about having the, like, true, real Photoshop on the iPad. Mm-hmm. There are still some limitations. They said it will not be like a perfect one-to-one, but it's not like a, here's a pun, it's not a GIMPed version of the software on the iPad. And the demo that was shown here by, I believe it wasn't an Adobe person, I think it was somebody from The Verge's staff, it looked pretty easy to use. It looked like they had done a lot of things to try to make it so that, you know, if you have an iPad Pro and the Apple Pencil, the touch environment still works. And it's never, I think, going to 100% overcome. There's a video in here too, I think, where some people from other parts of the staff were like, yeah, you know, I know a lot of the keyboard shortcuts to do certain things that I do repetitively, and we don't have a keyboard on this, so that will take some getting used to. So I think Adobe will probably have to continue to refine that and make it so that there are, you know, easy repetitive actions that can be done for folks that that do that sort of thing. But it certainly seems like it's a big step in the right direction towards having, you know, these quote-unquote pro tools on the iPad. And I'm trying to look for pricing. The thing I saw was that it was going to be part of the Adobe Creative Cloud licensing, but I don't know if there was going to be a separate non-Creative Cloud subscription pricing as well.
Yeah, I don't believe there is. I kind of read through both of these articles, and I got the impression that it's going to be a part of the Creative Cloud subscription, which is around, I think it's around, for Photoshop alone, it's around $20 a month, which is still reasonable, because I think Photoshop used to be like $800 or $900 to buy in when it was a retail box, right? The for me, the thing is, like, you know, I mean, I like to to use my fingers on my iPad and stuff like that. And that's a challenge with doing fine things. But of course, you know, you've got the access to the Apple Pencil, which gives you more fine control. And lack of a keyboard, I'll talk about that too in my pick. But that would be another consideration. But I would assume that you would be able to bring up the, you know, the iPad keyboard and key things in. You know, a lot of work done in Photoshop is done with layers as well, like and you know, a lot of the filters and effects tools. So it'll be interesting to see how that works. And one of the things that I do as when I'm doing my digital art in Photoshop is I'll open multiple images and I'll drag elements from one file to another, and then, you know, layer them and, you know, play around with them and stuff like that, and composite them, I guess is the term. So I'd be interested to see how they're going to handle that kind of stuff. I mean, there's a lot of the drag and drop mechanism that's in the iPad now, right? That may be one of the ways they'll get around that. I do have the other Photoshop apps on my iPad, and I play around them every now and then, but they're not quite Photoshop-y, I'm doing air quotes here, in the same sense that the desktop version is, right?
Right. And something they mentioned related to this announcement was their concept of the cloud PSD.
Yeah.
PSD exactly, being the file format that Photoshop uses, and that it would work pretty much like Google Docs does, where you can collaborate pretty seamlessly. So you could start something on your desktop and then sort of move to your couch on your iPad and continue working without a hitch.
Yeah, that's huge. I mean, that the ability to, like, you know, I think one of the things about, you know, iCloud, and I use Adobe Cloud with Acrobat currently. They have like a document cloud where, so I can have files that are, you know, on my local, on my iOS device, or I can have it in the cloud so I can access from my Mac or from my iPads or my iPhone. But yeah, the whole sticking stuff, I mean, Pages has done that, you know, with Pages and Numbers and stuff like that, and Google Docs, as you mentioned, right? So the Photoshop file format in the sky is cool. And I think one of the articles that we've got posted here also wonders whether Illustrator is on the heels of Photoshop. And it could be, too, that, you know, we have that upstart, well, they're not an upstart company, they've been around for a long time, but the designer people, you know, the...
Like Affinity Designer?
Affinity Designer, yeah. They have an Affinity Photo and Affinity Designer, which are basically their competitors to Photoshop and Illustrator. They're, you know, like they're possible ways that you can, and they're a one-time purchase software, right? So you pay $50. I'm just pulling a number out of my head. I don't really know, but I don't remember. But you pay that one-time cost, and then you have, you know, a fully functional, you know, app on your iOS device, or you pay a little bit more and you have one on your desktop, right? And then of course their files are interchangeable as well. So that could be part of the motivation behind why Photoshop's or Adobe's come to the table in this sense, right? Besides the fact that it's like the number one tool for this kind of work, right?
Yeah, I mean, it totally makes sense from their perspective, because they were, you know, leaving money on the table, so to speak.
Yeah.
Clearly, there are competitors who filled the void while they weren't there. And I think it just enhances the value for their Creative Cloud subscription pricing, where, you know, I imagine it's like a bring whatever device you've got, we'll support it sort of thing. Is, you know, it makes that, what do you say, $20 a month for Photoshop? That makes
roughly,
it more,
yeah, roughly
more palatable.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, yeah, like the whole thing with the Surface is it's a full Windows operating system. So they've had Photoshop for all this time, right? Like, I think the one time I went and did a demo on either on the I don't know if it was the Studio Surface Studio or the Surface device itself, but I fired up a copy of Photoshop and it was just like working on the desktop, right? Except I was on a touch device, right? Yeah, looking forward to it. I mean, the reason why I had it as follow-up is because we've been talking about this kind of one day Photoshop's going to do something on the iPad or iPhone or whatever to, you know, make our lives better in some way.
In a long enough timeline, everything is follow-up, right? We could talk around the June timeframe. It's like, follow-up to last year, there's a new version of iOS coming out this week. That's true.
Everything is follow-up to that first announcement by Steve Jobs 10 years ago or whenever it was.
It's the first iPod when he brought up the iPod out of his pocket. Everything's been follow up, right?
Right, right.
Or ever since the Mac said, "Hello, I'm Macintosh," you know, coming out of the bag. Yeah, right. It all goes back to Alan Turing, if you really want to look at it that way.
Sure. Back to the first caveman who figured out how to add two numbers together. Was caveman, whoever it was.
Yeah, yeah. His cousin invented the wheel.
Yeah.
A few months later. All right. So, yeah. And the next story you have here, Jaime, why don't you lead into that one?
Yeah, I have no idea this is available anywhere other than the US, and of course the EU, because this is follow-up to the GDPR, the General Data Protection Regulation that the European Union instituted earlier this year. As part of that, Apple, in this case, made it possible for you to download all your data that they have about you. And it was not available outside of the EU, but now it is, and at least the United States. I have no idea if, what is it, privacy.apple.com, you'll be able to log in with your Apple ID, and my understanding is it does ask one of your devices for a, or sends a code to one of your other devices, so, you know, trying to address the concern a lot of folks have met online of like, oh no, like now I can, you know, now criminals just go in and get my info. It's like, well, they'll have to have your device too. So they'll have to have your Apple ID, your password information, and the device, which at that point, like, I don't know why they're downloading your data anyways. They might as well go buy some stuff and move to another country. But yeah, I guess it's there. People are still following along to see what it is. It apparently is not instantaneous. It takes several days to maybe like about a week to get your info, apparently. And folks were wondering, I think originally it didn't have photos in there, but it seems like there's been subsequent updates to say that, yep, photos are included as part of the data. I guess it could be a nifty way to get like a huge data dump for all your iCloud photo data and move it somewhere else off-site, I suppose, if you wanted to.
Mm-hmm. Or over to Google. Yeah, it's interesting. It's been available in May since for the people in the EU because of the GDPR, but and you know, it's available to you on, in the US of A. Yeah. And it's funny because I noticed that that piece you were talking about, the way that one device vets you, is, I can't remember what one of my Apple apps, it might be Logic or I can't remember which one it was, but I had to actually go in and make a specific login for that application. Like, you know how in Google, when two-factor authentication first came along, you had to make a key for each account you were using or each way you accessed it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like it was sort of a way of vetting it. Let me just look at my Apple ID here.
Yeah, so you mean like your iPhone and your iPad would end up having to get app-specific or device-specific tokens sort of generated for them?
Yeah. Oh, you know what it was? It was the app uploader. The remember the other day I was having trouble with uploading my app to the to iTunes? So when I wanted to use the application loader, Apple made me go into my Apple ID and make a specific key for that application so that they could prove that it was really, you know, it wasn't just me logging in through, you know, this app randomly. It was actually... It was like another code signing that was happening between the app and my computer, right? So, or myself somehow, right? But I had to make a specific app password for under my Apple ID in order to upload. So I wonder if that's all part of this same sort of thing, like you were saying, that they're one of the ways Apple's going to require that you authenticate yourself sort of doubly to prove that it's really you to get your data, right?
Yeah. And I think probably the funniest thing I saw online was somebody really, really grumpy about like, oh, well, this second authentication part assumes that you're current Apple customer, but like, what if I had like an iPod like 10 years ago and now I'm on an Android device, and like, how do I get this? Like, well, sucks to be you, buddy, because you know, the solution isn't going to be perfect for everyone. Maybe they'll have a like go into an Apple store and bring your device and here you go, here's your data sort of thing. I mean,
well, there is kind of a way that they solved this, because you know, I think I mentioned before that I run my servers run older versions of OS. Like, I think one of them's on 10.6 or like Snow Leopard. I was actually reformatting a computer at work today, and it was it came up with Mavericks when I went to reinstall the OS. And when I went to log into the Apple ID, it asked me, like, the way they get around that is because, you know, all the new machines ask you for the verification code, the 6-digit code that you get from your account, your 2-factor authentication.
Mm-hmm.
So on those older devices, you put in your Apple ID as the username, and you put your password plus the 6-digit code. So you do the password and that all in one string, right? And it has to be like, you know, fresh off your phone or whatever. And that. So, but Apple has kind of thought about how they're dealing with older devices, right? In the case of Mavericks, it was able, the prompt was there to tell me to add the 6-digit code. But on Yosemite and, you know, Snow Leopard, I had to remember to add that. I would try to log into the Apple Store for whatever reason, or, you know, to iTunes or what have you, and it would just look at me like it kind of like, no, it wouldn't shake to say no, like, you know, it does that when you got the wrong information. It would just sort of look at me sideways, and you know, I had to remember to put the 6-digit code in the end of it. I had to, you know, Google it and Stack Overflow it or whatever to find out about that problem at first. But Apple has been thinking about how they're dealing with this this extra data they need, right?
Right.
To prove it's really Jaime. All right. So, anything else we want to say about this cool way of getting your data?
No. I mean, I think it'd be interesting to try it out myself at some point and see precisely what they have. But I kind of suspect there won't be any. I don't think there will be any sudden horrific realization organizations as there were with other companies who tended to have, you know, a lot more tracking of stuff to begin with. I think Apple's kept it pretty lean for
on the up and up,
you know, for their own particular reasons, right? Because they don't really have a business model based on tracking. They have a business model in making things that make you want to buy them. So totally different.
Yeah, it'd be interesting for me because I've been, you know, I've had a .Mac account forever, right? So like, I know there's some images out there because they used to have an image, a photo connection on Mobile Me for like, you know, you could have images up on there, and they closed that down years ago, right? But I'm sure those images are still floating around somewhere. Yeah, cool stuff. Like I haven't looked, I mean, I think I do, I get my .Mac email on my Mac now, but you know, for the longest time, there was like a period there, like 5-6 years ago or maybe more, where all we were getting spammed on that account too. So lots of fun. All right, so I guess we're at the picks, are we?
Yeah. I think so. I think it was the all follow-up show today.
The all follow-up show, yeah. All right, so shall I go first?
Yeah, go for it.
All right, so I got three things here. One of them is a LinkedIn video. I don't know if there's a, I'll have to see if there's a YouTube video version of it or whatever, but this is cool. It was demonstrating how Google, Amazon, Apple, and Tesla are solving first world problems. That's the headline from it. So what it shows is a video of a delivery guy from Amazon going to the door and ringing the doorbell. And of course, the person who, you know, has the house wasn't home. So he used his Nest camera to talk to the delivery guy and say, you know, from his phone, his Apple phone, and he would say, "Hey, you know, it's me. I'm not home right now." And the guys go, "Well, somebody's got to sign for the package." And he goes, "Well, hang on a second." And he opened up his Tesla app on his phone because his Tesla was parked in the driveway. And he said, "Let me see if I can unlock the trunk of the car." So he unlocked the trunk of the car, and so the trunk opened up, and he says, "Put the package in the Tesla." You know,
that's awesome.
And then he closed the lid, and the guy's like, "Wow, that's amazing, right?" So it's like right out of Silence of the Lambs. You know, put the lotion in the basket. You know, but yeah, it was pretty cool stuff. Yeah, and that was, you know, sort of basically Google, Amazon, Tesla, and Apple all solving the problem of how to sign for a package when you're not at home. Amazing.
Neither company really working together on it, but it was interesting that somebody was able to stitch together their own solution.
And he made a video of it at the same time. I guess he must have recorded it with the Nest Cam, right?
Yeah. Like, I know that Amazon is trialing out this sort of capability of having, I think we talked about on the show, the delivery person who can deliver stuff into your house using their camera system and their door locking system.
Yeah.
And also trialing out the delivering to the trunk of your car. Not in any arbitrary place, apparently, just either in your driveway, as in this individual's example, or in your work parking lot. So, like, not on the freeway, not at the AMW on 45th Street or something.
You're driving down the Highway 55 and the trunk opens and the Amazon guy just throws the package in. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like a scene out of a James Bond movie or something, right? Mission Impossible.
But right. It does seem like a strangely reasonable way for somebody to show, like, yeah, you know, it's supposed to be delivered to this address. There is the vehicle that's described at this address. And, you know, if you've ever had anything pulled out from one of those, like, I know Amazon has the Amazon Locker. I think Walmart has something similar, or maybe Home Depot. I'm thinking of something with an orange sort of theme. Maybe even both of them have it. You know, it's sort of like a lockbox and kind of a reasonable one. I mean, yeah, I suppose it hypothetically makes your vehicle more tempting than it already is as a target for, you know, thievery. But if you're okay with that particular risk factor, then it seems better than leaving it on your doorstep, which certainly I've seen probably hundreds of videos of people posting on their Nest or their Ring doorbell video camera that's like, "Oh, look, somebody sketchy came by and stole stuff, you know, my Amazon delivery package right off my porch."
Yeah, I've had stuff stolen directly off my front porch.
Yeah, and your porch is hidden too.
It is, yeah. It's behind the gate, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. No, we've had stuff disappear off our porch too, yeah. But they won't take the garbage we leave on our porch, I don't understand. But
yeah, you keep leaving it out there hoping someone will come take it.
I know, I just like, here, take it away. Well, you know, in our neighborhood, you can put metal, if you put metal out, there are people driving around in trucks who will just come and get the metal because they sell it to the scrappers, right?
There are people who dig through our recycling and get cans and things like that.
Yeah, we have people, there's an entire income of people living like that. So I just leave the cans and whatever on my porch for them to take.
Yep.
Come help yourself. All right. Well, my next pick is, I may know about this. I may have known about this many years ago and I've forgotten what it was, but I went through I installed Mojave on my computer and every couple of days it kept popping up and saying, "Hey, you want to find out what's new in Mojave?" And to be honest with you, I don't remember a lot of the stuff that they showed at WWDC. So I figured, you know, okay, sure. I'll just, you know, click on the thing. and it took me to an HTML page and whatever. And I went through it, and one of the keyboard commands were for taking screenshots, which I thought was interesting. You know, Command-Shift-3 will take a screenshot of your entire window, including, you know, from stem to stern, the whole thing, right? And if you hold Command-Shift-4, it gives you a cursor, and you can drag a marquee around to take part of the shot, right? But if you have, if you want to take a, if you have like a dialogue window, like a pane from System Preferences or something like that, and you want to take a screenshot of that, Command-Shift-5 will take a screenshot of just that pane. But I don't know if you, or just the window. Like if I have a, like I'm looking at the Google Docs window in Safari, if I did Command-Shift-5 right now, it would just take that application window, whatever the active window is. So I don't know. Have you guys heard of that command before? Or?
I just tried it right now. It actually opened up, I think even better than what you said, it opened up a resizable box.
Right, yeah. So this is this part of, I think this is part, the resizable box thing is now part of, yeah, like mine is, oh, as, in my case, I'm hovering my it gives me like a cursor that I can hover over the window, mm-hmm. and I can just click on it, and let me see, I just click on this one here. Yeah, you're right, and it does a little box in the bottom yep. corner.
And it is the same, it's the same box that you get when you, in Mojave, when you select the screenshot, I guess it's an app that's in your dock that showed up in your dock.
Right, oh really?
I think that replaced Grab.
Oh, okay.
Right, yeah, so Grab is gone in Mojave, right, and they've got this new thing called Screenshot, which I think actually works quite a bit better.
Hmm. Well, it does the same thing like this, like it opens it up and lets you annotate it like it does on the phone, right? You can mm-hmm. I just deleted it because I don't want to keep the screenshot. But yeah, it's kind of cool. So whether Command Shift 5 was there all along and we've just forgotten about it, and or now Apple's just enhanced it with this ability to preview mm-hmm. And I guess move the thing around. Because one of the things I love about my phone is if I want to post an image or screenshot to Twitter or put it in a text message or something, is I can take an image and it gives you that little floating box and you tap on it and go and edit it. You can use the share sheet action to share it to Facebook or Twitter or whatever, and then delete the image when you're done, because you just want to put it out there. You don't want to keep a copy of it, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas before you'd have to take a shot into your photo album and then send it from there. So that's kind of cool. So Command-Shift-5, that's for taking screenshots of the active window.
Nice.
With enhancements on from Mojave. Cool. The other one is real quick is we were talking about Luna Display. It's one of the projects that I backed when I first heard about it. And you can buy it. Luna Display, what it does is it's from the people who make AstroPad, which is the app that you load it up on your Mac, and you load it up on your iPad, and you can use your pencil or you can use your finger too. And it gives you a window of what's on your Mac screen. So you can manipulate the content of your screen like you're using a graphic tablet, right? Sort of like a Wacom or something like that, or Cintiq. And I believe it's got a keyboard too. And it's got some keyboard commands or shortcuts in there built into I have the AstroPad Studio version. I have a year subscription so I can play around with that. But Luna Display, it's a little hardware device. It's a little dongle you stick into your either your USB-C port or your Thunderbolt port. I bought one for Thunderbolt Display too. I put one for my Thunderbolt port. And what it does, it makes my iPad into either a second screen on the Mac, or, you know, if I want a mirror display, I can just basically drive the screen from my Mac. So I took it out for a spin quickly today. Basically it was just a matter of downloading the two pieces of software. They immediately connected each other and found themselves, and it was like almost zero config. I didn't have to do anything like in terms of entering codes or whatever. It just magically worked. And how is that going to work if you have multiple iPads and like if you're in an office or something like that? Anywho, there must be some way of connecting the two of them, or syncing, like deciding which one of the many iPads you have in your office that'll work with it. My only complaint about it was because I'd love to sit at my desk or my couch with my iPad and use my iPad to drive my Mac, but I don't have an external keyboard for my iPad, right? So that was the one thing, is you can't bring up the I would think, you know, why couldn't you bring up the iPad screen, you know, the iPad virtual keyboard and, you know, just key stuff in on the iPad. But that seems to be, it does support external keyboards, of course, like if you had a Bluetooth keyboard or if you had the smart keyboard for the iPad Pro, that would be a solution. But just one thing that's the only thing that's missing, in my opinion, from this product. Otherwise, it was like zero config, up and running. I'm running on a 13-inch Air, so the screen resolution is pretty similar to the resolution on the iPad. I think there's a little bit of black bars that happen on the side of the, when I was mirroring the display, a little bit of black bar happening on the Mac itself as it just mirrored the resolution. resolution of the iPad, but yeah, otherwise it was pretty similar. Yeah, so it's great. It does not, I mean, like if you have a Retina Mac, it's not going to get, you're not going to get Retina on the iPad, obviously, right? You're going to get whatever the iPad resolution is, but yeah, nice, smooth, easy to use product. So, and it's, and I mentioned last week, it's now available to the public for purchase, right? So you can just go to the lunadisplay.com and buy one yourself. So I highly recommend it. It's pretty cool. And it's tiny. It's like smaller than, not even smaller than a USB dongle. Like it's just a little tiny thing, right? Easy to lose, I'm sure. That's my pick. So, honey, sorry, I have one more pick. What am I crazy? This is just a quickie. Saw this posted by one of the guys on the Ray Wunderlich Black. It's just a quick little illustration of, it's called the Illustrator TLS connection, and it goes through the steps that the client and server do when they're talking to each other and exchanging, you know, bits of information in a TLS connection. So if you're curious about how they work, if you click on any one of the, it basically puts a series of buttons on the, in your web browser, and you just click on any one of them at any stage. You've got client hello, server hello, server certificate, and exchange, and you can see the sort of bits and pieces and an explanation of what's going on, and some, you know, basically hexadecimal code there to show you what's really going on, like the certificate and what part of his certificate, what part's the beginning and ending, and all that kind of stuff. So if you're curious about what goes on in the exchange between your client and your server in a TLS connection, take a look at this link. I'll link in the show notes. And that's about it. So, Jaime, do you have a pick?
I do. We were talking about this pre-show because it was a little confusing. So Swift and Fika, F-I-K-A, was a conference in Stockholm, Sweden that took place in September. I saw that the videos for the conference are on YouTube, so that's what we've linked in the show notes for those of you driving home. We have, what, looks like 11 videos from the conference. And I've not had a chance to watch them, but it looks like there could be some interesting topics here, like adventures in API design, performance of standard iOS elements in tech, and probably how not to write Swift with Paul Hudson is probably one I'll end up watching. That's got a tantalizing name, so I feel like it's drawing me in.
Cool. Have to check some of those out.
Yeah, and Fika, apparently it's linked on the homepage for the conference, is a Swedish term for a coffee break that's more about socializing than drinking coffee.
Hmm.
Huh. And apparently, so they're saying that conference is
more about socializing than learning about coding? Or is that what they're saying?
I have no idea. I feel like there's a cultural disconnect there, maybe, but
yeah, maybe
it's about building community. Because it looks, I mean, if there's only 11 videos, it probably was a single track conference.
Mm.
So I imagine it's sort of a smaller,
maybe it's just a one day thing, more of a workshop kind of thing than a full conference.
Yeah, yeah. So could be that it was like about building the community around that sort of thing.
All right. So Mark, hit us with your pick.
So my pick, well, it's a little bit of a shameless self-promotion, but as I've mentioned many times on the show before, I work for a startup called Skydio, and we make a self-flying autonomous drone. And our big news that just came out today is that our Skydio R1 drone is now available for sale in the Apple retail store. So you can go and check it out and have a look at it. And coinciding with the Apple store release is a new version of our app that has the first version of our Apple Watch app that I wrote that you can actually use to fly the drone. And so I included a couple of links to some of the press. I have to say we've gotten some really, really nice press coverage on this, and they seem to like what we've done. So if you're interested in drones, I would go check it out at the Apple store. And you know, if you do, wear your MTJC t-shirt, take a picture of you looking at the at the drone in the store, and maybe we'll post it in the show notes, or maybe even send you a sticker or something like that.
Sure. So I have to ask about the watch app. So is this a watch model you recommend with this thing? Like, what about responsiveness and all that kind of stuff?
Well, of course, you know, the later version you have, the better. The Series 4 is going to work the best. But I actually did a lot of the development on a Series 2, and it works fine. So Series 2 or above is great. We have tested it on Series 1, and, you know, obviously it's not going to be as responsive or as fast on Series 1, but pretty much anything will work.
And there's a lot of intelligence. You use computer vision in the drone. We've mentioned that before. So it must, the drone must sort of fly itself, and it's like sending a probe to Mars in terms of like using a Series 1, I guess, right?
Exactly, yeah. So what makes our drone different than most of the ones you get out there is most of them, you have to use a set of joysticks or something like that, and you have to be kind of an expert drone flyer in order to fly a thing so you don't crash it into something. And you know, I hear a lot of stories about people buy these drones and they have drive it for a week and then they crash it and then it's destroyed. So ours, you don't fly it in a traditional way, although you can. We do have that option, but most of the time you don't do it. It's controlled by just some very simple controls from before, now the phone and now also from the watch, where we, as you said, Tim, we use a whole set of computer vision and machine learning algorithms to have the vehicle figure out what's around it and in doing so knows how to avoid obstacles. And the way you fly it essentially is you tell it where to go by tapping on your phone screen or selecting a target, which could be a person or a car or something like that. And then you tell it what mode to do this in. It can be something like follow mode is the basic one, which just follows you, or there's a lead mode where it stays ahead of you and points backwards, or there's an orbit mode where it will kind of fly around you. And there's all sorts of modes. There's probably at least 20 different modes right now. So you can select those modes on the watch now. You can select your targets. We show little thumbnails of all of the potential follow targets that are visible to the vehicle. And you can select one and do all that with the watch. We also have, this will be of interest to developers, we've also just announced a new SDK. So if you are a developer who's interested in developing for the vehicle, for the drone, sign up on our website, www.skydio.com. And so we're actually looking for some partners to do some early development using the SDK.
Cool. And it's like not one of these things, like you couldn't tell the thing to fly into a wall. Like, is it? Like,
right. No, that's exactly, sorry, I didn't make that clear. That's exactly the whole point of it, because the vehicle is aware of what's around itself and it builds this 3D map of the world around it. If you tell it to go follow you, it will actually avoid obstacles. So if there's a tree branch in the way, it'll go around the tree branch. If there's a brick wall, it'll go over the brick wall and keep following you as it does it. That's what's pretty amazing. Check out the videos in the links I sent, and there's a whole bunch more. Do a Google search on Skydio and you'll see all sorts of stuff, or look on YouTube. There's lots of videos there. You can see what it can do.
Well, this is how Skynet starts, right?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I see why you might say that. It seems like the hard kill or hunter killers, I forget what they were called, the HKs from Terminator and Terminator 2. But I think the happier thing that I looked at was like the family video they show on the YouTube video, mm-hmm. maybe about a minute, where you can have the kids interact with stuff or have it follow one versus the other. That seemed pretty seamless and fun to use. So
yeah,
it seems very, very exciting. And congrats on getting that into the Thank store you. And everything. Thank that's, you. That's a huge thing.
And we choose to use our power for good, not evil.
Uh-huh. For capturing memories, not capturing people.
That's right.
Tell me a little bit about the SDK. Is it, I'm sure people are out there are clamoring and wondering, is it an Objective-C or a Swift SDK?
Is it open source? It's a Swift SDK, but of course, just like anything else on iOS, if you're developing in Objective-C, you can just use bridging headers to pull the Swift side in.
Cool.
Yeah.
Do you pull it in as a CocoaPod cartridge, copy and paste the files over? How does that work?
There will be a CocoaPod soon, yes. Yeah, for right now, that's not ready yet, but it will be soon. So by the time anyone hears this, probably, we should be close to having that ready.
Right. Hmm. Is it a framework now, or how does it work?
It is a framework, yes. Yeah, it's a couple of different frameworks that you import.
Right. Yeah, traditional.
Yep, pretty standard.
But technically, it's a third-party framework, right, Mark?
It is, I know, yeah.
All right. Well, that sounds like fun.
Yeah.
So it's can you tell us what they retail for? Like, are you allowed to say?
Or? Sure. Oh, yeah. It's public information. It's $19.99
mm-hmm. US dollars.
Right. And that's some people are going to say, wow, that's kind of expensive for a drone because you can get a lot of them for much less. Yeah. But when you see the thing and see what it can do, I have to say so myself. When it's pretty amazing. So if this is your thing, I think you'll find it worth the money.
Sure. Is it come assembled like or as you see in the picture here, or is there some assembly required?
No assembly required. There's basically only a couple of different pieces that you can even take off. There's propellers that it comes with propellers, of course, but if, sometimes it can happen that a propeller breaks or something like that. And so you can get new ones and put those on. And the battery pushes into the side or to the back. It has kind of a magnetic clamp holding it on. So those, obviously when you charge the battery, you pull the thing out and put it in a charger. So you have to put that in every time you use it.
So you can have a couple of batteries and sort of never run out.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Right. Cool. Yeah, I see in the picture here, there's a camera above and there's two two cameras on top and assume there's cameras all around?
There's actually 13 cameras.
Wow.
One of them is the 4K video camera. Mm-hmm. That when you see videos, that's coming from the 4K video. And the other 12 are used for navigation. So there's six pairs of cameras all around the thing. And that's how it kind of builds this world map of what's around it in all different directions.
Hmm. Here's a dumb question. Does it remember the world map between flights or?
It does not remember the world map. No. It's because it's all real time. It's just all done in real time.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. At some point, probably it will add some extra memory in there. So if you go to the same place twice, it will kind of have a rough memory of what was there. But the truth is things are changing, right? So mm-hmm. So if you're trying to avoid a tree and you know the wind blows and it blows the branch of the tree, you don't want the drone to be remembering where the tree branch was last time you flew. You want to know where it is now. So there's not a huge amount of reason to keep that map around from flight to flight.
So can it handle, like if there's a wind blowing, like I guess up to a certain force, it can manage the wind as well? Like
Of course there's if it's too windy, you wouldn't want to fly the thing in a hurricane, obviously.
Right.
Too windy, it won't be able to keep up just because it's getting blown away so much it won't be able to stay on the path that you set. And we have warnings that come up. If it gets too windy, both the app and the watch app will give you a warning saying it's too windy, you want to land. And if it gets mm-hmm. really too windy that it just can't fly anymore, it will do an auto landing and just go down to save itself.
Right. Can you do search and rescue kind of stuff with it? Like if you wanted to say, can you say fly out 500 yards that way and come back? And
sure, you can do that kind of thing. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yep.
Or set like a patrol for it to go back and forth across a certain path or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. In fact, these cinematic moves or actually skills is what we call them. Mm-hmm. You can develop your own we have actually two different SDKs. We have this skills SDK, which let you define things like that. And we have the app development SDK as well.
Oh, neat.
Yeah.
Any more questions, Jaime?
No, this is fantastic stuff.
Cool. Yeah. I'm pretty excited about it. So hopefully everyone will go check it out.
Yeah. Well, hopefully they'll let one fly around in the Apple store.
Yeah.
Or the Eaton Center. The Eaton Center is pretty big.
Yeah.
All right. So I guess that's it for another week. So Jaime, if people want to get in touch with you on the interwebs, where would they look?
I'm on Twitter as @devwiththehair.
All right. And Mark, if people want to get in touch with you?
MarkR@synopsoft.com.
And MarkR@Skydio.
There's also Mark at Skydio. Yeah.
MarkAtSkydio.com. All right.
Yep.
As I say every week, my name is Timitra, TimMitra on the Twitcher machine is how to get a hold of me. And until next week, we'll see you later. Bye.
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 If you want to find out more about the podcast or see the episode show notes, visit the More Than Just Code website at mtjc.fm. You can get in touch with us on the website or follow us on Twitter at mtjc_podcast. If you have feedback or questions, send us a tweet with the hashtag AskMTJC. If you like the show, please consider recommending us to a friend, writing a review on iTunes, or pledging any amount at patreon.com/MTJC. You can find details on how to help us out on our website at mtjc.fm/sponsor us. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Yeah, so I went to the Eaton Center to see if your drone was there, Mark, and it wasn't.
It wasn't there, yeah. Well, I do know that some of the stores in Toronto got them.
Yeah, well, whether they got them and put them out is two different things, right? Because it's up to the managers, right, to put it out.
Sure, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Like when I got my iPad Pro, I went there the day they came out, and I didn't see them anywhere, and I just went to look, right? And then some guy brought one from the back for some lady who bought the first one, and I said, oh, do you have those? And he goes, yeah, they're in the back. We haven't brought them out yet. So
yeah.
I said, well, can I see one? By the time he handed it to me, I'm like, okay, here's my money. You know, does it have a case? Can I get Apple Care, you know? Yeah.
Maybe it'll show up in a couple of days, or maybe it'll be at the other store. Who knows?
Well, like the Yorkdale Mall is more she kind of like mall.
It's probably bigger, that one.
Well, I mean, Eaton's is a big deal too. Like it's on the third. Right. Eaton's has like it's a three story thing. It's like a city block long. And it's been there since the 70s. I used to hang around. We were hung around it when it was being constructed when we were kids. But, you know, it's like one of those typical Paris indoor malls. It's got the dome ceiling and the whole, like, glass dome ceiling, like a big greenhouse ceiling. Mm. And the third floor stores are, like, all the fancy jewelry and, you know, places like that, right? Mm-hmm. There's some American chains moved into the end of the mall there. I forget what it's called. But, yeah, and then it's not Nordstrom's, but something like that. Oh, maybe it is Nordstrom's in that mall. But the Yorkdale Mall is huge. It's like, you know, the huge megaplex mall, and there's like gobs of parking all the way around it. Like you can park, like it's like 3 or 4 football fields long of parking, you know.
Right, right. Yeah.
You know, and it's just like, it's just, and Saturdays and Sundays, it's just like there's nowhere to park because it's like completely full. And it's like, you know, they have all the fancy restaurants and, you know, and then the Apple Store and the Microsoft Store are like, you know, 3 or 4 stores apart, and they're really big shops, like, you know, like the one at Yorkdale, I'm pretty sure it's about as wide as the one in Palo Alto, mm-hmm. you know, like that big fancy one they have there.
Yep.
Yeah. So I would expect that they would have more shelf space for that kind of stuff. Right.
Right.
And it's funny when we're going to talk about Apple Store in a little bit in the show here. And in the video that I've got clipped in here, the store that they show in the video is the Yorkdale store. Hmm. You can tell by the Genius, they have a bar at the back of the store, which is where the Genius bar is. Right, so is that what they call it, Genius Bar?
Genius Bar, yeah,
yeah,
yep.
Yeah. Whereas the one in Toronto or Eaton Centre, it's they've basically encroached on the tables where the products are. There's so many people there to see the Geniuses that they've just, you know, those big marble table or those maple tables. They've taken them over. So at the front of the store is all the product, and then the back half of the store is all people at the Genius Bar. Hmm. Like, and it's packed. You know, there's usually like 10 or 12 people around each table, right? So getting repairs or advice or what have you. Yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, Margaret, I don't know how you feel about giving like a conference presentation, but it strikes me that this would be one of those like really cool sort of things to have at a conference.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, I have been thinking about that.
Well, you have it fly around and like sort of fly around and focus on you and show the video on the screen as you're talking about it.
Yeah, you absolutely can. Yeah. it would have to be a conference that allows commercial type presentations.
Right.
Right? A lot of them don't. A lot of them don't want you to just have any kind of product mention at all.
Mm. But, oh, that's true.
Yeah, but I think it would be kind of cool. Yeah, I was thinking, you know, 360 IDEV or something. Well, that one just passed, but next summer. Or maybe NS North.
That's in April.
When's the call for papers?
I don't know. I should ask Dan. Let me ask him now.
Do they allow this kind of stuff?
I don't know. Well, they had the iBeacon stuff, right? You know?
But I guess it probably wasn't like a vendored solution. I think if I get what Mark's getting at, you probably want something where like dev advocates from Azure or Google Cloud or AWS can present a session. And, you know, it can be partially sort of businessy, which I think is what people are concerned about. But I think in this case, mm-hmm. this is like a legitimately cool SDK that people can use. It's not just like, hey, here's our product. Take a look at it. It's like, oh, look, you can go build stuff with it. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But it seems perfectly valid to me. But Mark's right. You definitely have to find a conference that is cool with that sort of thing. And then
Amy Winehouse is coming back as a hologram.
Really?
That is going to cause everybody who's even remotely a celebrity to think about posthumous control of their own rights. If you know, obviously not for themselves because they'd be dead, but for their estate and how that works. Mm. So I don't know. I've been really kind of impressed by you know they're a competitor for, I guess, both of us, Tim, but Capital One's selection of Michael Jackson and Prince and Whitney Houston for their recent ad campaigns.
Oh, really?
And I know that there are Prince fans who are kind of more miffed about it. And hypothetically, if Prince had, you know, thought about this, he probably would have maybe put it in his state that they couldn't do this sort of thing. But it certainly is something that people have to think about. I mean, look at Rogue One with Peter Cushing.
Right. Yeah,
revived. And as that technology gets better, we're only going to see it, you know, more and more in the future.
Not to mention Carrie Fisher, right?
She's always complained that George Lucas owned her image, right? Every time she looked in the mirror, she had to send him royalties.
Did you guys see the deep fakes that somebody was doing? doing with the Solo movie, the Solo Star Wars movie.
No,
where they put
really?
Harrison Ford's face on the actor. This.
Yeah.
No, what was the deal with that?
You know, the deepfake technology where you can take one person's face and put it on another person's body? They did that. And so they overwrote the, I forget the main actor's name in Solo. They overwrote his face with a somewhat de-aged Harrison Ford from
really?
Probably like Star Wars, the original, because it seemed rather young to me.
Hmm. Yeah, on YouTube or whatever? Or?
I'll see if I can find a link. It's probably on YouTube by now if it hasn't been taken down. If not, I'll see if there's a Verge article or something.
That's cool. Does YouTube take stuff down?
All the time. It kind of depends on how aggressive the rights folks are.
Hmm. Interesting. Well, we're waiting for that. You guys heard Paul Allen died?
Yeah. He's pretty young.
Was he?
Like 65.
Really? Wow. Did he say why or how?
Hodgkin's lymphoma.
Oh, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma.
Non-Hodgkin's.
I'm not sure what that means because I didn't look it up.
Yeah, I think the bad one is non-Hodgkin's, right? Apparently. Yeah.
Oh, is he?
Yeah.
Huh, interesting. That would check.
Yeah.
So in case you're wondering, it's now 7-5 Red Sox in the bottom of the seventh. But the Astros have a man on first, one out. Oh, just popped up. Okay, two outs.
In the seventh inning, you said?
Bottom of the seventh, yes.
What's the score again?
7-5. Game's been going back and forth. You know, one run leads back and forth and trading off.
Hmm. Is that very competent?
Very competent? What do you mean?
One team over the other, I mean.
Well, it's two very closely matched teams, so,
right.
So it goes back.
Mm-hmm. That's a crapshoot.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay, I think I found one. People have been trying it for a while, so I think this is the one that was posted today. One sec. Okay, I put it below Mark's Skydio pick. It was in the show notes.
So, hey, Mark, have you been watching Doctor Who?
Yeah, although I didn't finish the end of last episode because for some reason. So I have it on tape. Not tape.
And yeah, no, I know
that shows how old I am. Yeah. You know, it's okay, but I'm not blown away by it. It's nothing to do with her. It's just the stories have been just kind of dull, I thought. I don't know.
Yeah.
But you know what? When the last guy first started, Peter Capaldi first started, I didn't think he was that. They were that great too. But he grew on me. So she.
Yeah, it's funny. I was looking at the new the interior of the new TARDIS. I wasn't thrilled with it when I first saw it.
Oh, I haven't seen it yet because that must be at the end of this episode, right?
No, never mind. I didn't say that. I meant her new Volkswagen. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, no, I knew it was coming because when I stopped watching, they were about to go find it or something like that.
Yeah.
So I know it's coming.
But just so, because we were just telling Jaime about the fact that Doctor Who has two hearts and stuff like that. So Jaime's never seen Doctor Who before, right?
Never?
So,
ever?
Well, until last week when I saw the Series 11, Episode 1.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, so I've been familiar enough with the with its place in culture. And so I knew a little bit about stuff like the Sonic Screwdriver and the Companions and the TARDIS. Yeah. But sort of like at the level of like somebody who, you know, who's never seen Star Trek, but like they know... you know, about Kirk and Spock and other sort of things that leech out into the mainstream.
Right. Well, I think you have to go back to the beginning and binge watch the whole
thing.
No,
I don't think so. I
mean, I'll find the lost episodes on the dark web, you know?
Right.
Well,
right.
You know, most people who watch it now started with Christopher Eccleston's series with Billy Piper.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
The next generation, basically. But what I was going to say, though, about the TARDIS is with every actor who becomes the Doctor or with every incarnation of the Doctor, the TARDIS also changes.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny though, because you know the TARDIS was supposed to be this ship that could morph into anything, like it could look like anything on the outside, but it's broken. It's stuck on being a police box,
right?
So, which is why it always
kind of been broken for the past 50 years,
at least.
You know, you'd think back when he was hopping up to Gallifrey all the time, he could have just taken it into the shop, right?
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah,
did he go to Gallifrey a lot in the early days? I don't remember.
Back in the Tom Baker days. He went there a bunch of times.
Oh, did he? Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, he went to Gallifrey in a few of the Christmas specials, right? The one with where Tom Baker was the gallery guy at what do you call him?
Oh, yeah.
Because that was the three-dimensional painting from Gallifrey, right?
Right, right.
And they actually go into the painting.
And that was his first appearance since he left the show. He was always against coming back for all those.
Oh, was he?
Shows. Yeah.
Well, back when I started watching it, it was on PBS or whatever, and they were all out of order. So you would see John Pertwee episodes, and then you would see Colin Baker episodes. Sorry, Tom Baker.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. And I never watched any of the Doctors in the 80s or the 80, late 80s, right? You know, the guy that's David Tennant's father-in-law is the last Doctor I watched. He's, I forgot his name. I think he's, is he Baker?
Yeah, I mostly watched it when it was Tom Baker, and then the guy who followed him, the All Creatures Great and Small guy.
Yeah, him. Yeah, yeah. That's when I stopped watching it, too.
Yeah, yeah.
But I was confused by him at first, because I'd finished watching All Creatures Big, Great and Small, too.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I remember being confused, too, because I didn't know the Doctor regenerated, so I
was
watching it, and then all of a sudden there's a new guy. Wait a minute. I guess I missed the episodes where it happened, where he changed, so.
Well, I don't know. Are there episodes where they regenerate in the old days? I can't remember.
Yeah, yeah. There's one for each of them. I mean, it wasn't as CGI'd as it is now.
Yeah. So, Jaime, do you have any guesses as to why the Doctor regenerates? I mean, the real reason?
Probably because it's BBC and they don't have money for big time players. So it's like, hey, you want a new contract? No, guess what? We replace you with another actor. We'll just write it into the show that you regenerate.
Yeah. Well, there's actually a story about the original origins of the Doctor from when it was first put on TV. But the original actor was a bit grumpy, William Hartnell, and they thought he was having dementia. He was pretty old. He was like in his 60s or whatever, and they thought he was like having dementia or something like that. And so they felt they had to get, you know, he did a couple of seasons, maybe three or four seasons, and then they felt, three seasons, it says here, and then they felt they had to get a new guy, and so they came up with this way of switching out the actor. You know, pretty good run. I mean, it started in like 63, right?
So, yeah, something like that. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm just looking at that. I'm looking at the Wikipedia page right now. Mm. So the Doctor that is the one you and I are talking about is, after Tom Baker, is Peter Davidson.
Right, right.
Peter Davidson's daughter married David Tennant.
Oh, really?
So, yeah, sometimes you'll see two doctors out to dinner.
Hmm.
Yeah, yeah. 2005 is when the new Doctor came out. David Tennant was a Doctor for looks like 5 years here, and then Matt Smith was 3, and then yeah, so and then Peter Capaldi 3 as well.
Hmm.
Yeah, but David Tennant really sort of cemented the role. If you listen to Tammy, there's no other Doctor besides David Tennant.
Yeah, the kids today with their new Doctors and all that.
I know, eh?
You know. Tom Baker is the only real Doctor Who.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Mm. Don't you think?
Well, see, I started with John Pertwee, right?
So. Oh, okay. He was James
Bond. But I saw Tom Baker first, though, right?
Right, right.
Which didn't make any sense. Because, like back then, back in the 70s, you used to get, there used to be like six months to a year delayed in terms of coming over here to be played on American TV.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm pretty sure that I saw them out of order. Or unless I saw the early Pertwee playing Doctor Who, and just, I was so young I didn't remember watching it. But I remember he had that funny car, right?
Right.
Yellow car.
Yep.
Oh, and a TARDIS, I guess.
Well, he was the one that was, they took his TARDIS away, right? He was stranded on Earth.
Oh, was he?
At least at the beginning. Yeah, yeah.
Right. Yeah, because there's all these people like who, you know, they make all the, like there's the guys that make the 501 Legion that make all the Star Wars costumes and R2-D2s and stuff like that. There are people like that who do Doctor Who. Like at our fan expo, you'll see like a parade of Daleks that people have made, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they all drive, they sit in them and drive around in them and stuff like that. But this year I saw the yellow car that Pertwee, somebody made a version of it, right? So it wasn't the original one.
Mm-hmm.
Yep, lots of fun. Doctor Who, the Doctor. Mm-hmm. I mean, has no idea what we're talking about.
No.
Yeah, like I said, I had never seen an episode until last week. So
Wow, I'm amazed.
Mm-hmm. It's never made it onto my radar.
Stranger things have happened, yeah. No, we just saw it as an opportunity to sort of, because that's what they do on Sestercast. One lady's never seen Orphan Black and the other one's seen it like 3 times, right? So they talk about it from the perspective of someone who's just seeing it for the first time and then someone who's, you know, seen it many, many times, right?
Mm.
So, very interesting. All right. Anyway, I got to go pack it in because I'm running out of steam.
All right. I got to watch the end of the game. It's now the eighth inning. Red Sox is still up 7-5. Things are looking good. Fingers crossed.
Fingers crossed. Ooh, yep. All right.
All right, okay. Guys.
Talk
have a good week.
Later.
Talk to you later.
Yeah, you see it. Bye.
Bye. Bye.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.